Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
All right, welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City.
I'm Stan Campbell, also in Oklahoma City, on the opposite side of the city.
On the opposite side of town.
Opposite
Another
side
of the tracks.
That's right.
Man, it's good to have you here, man.
Man, it's always good to have
you. Had a good meeting this morning.
It's always good to have me here.
It's always good to have you here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a good meeting this morning, man, and looking forward to having you. So Stan's going to be moving back this year sometime later, or maybe next year.
Yeah, it'd be December, about Christmas time. You know, Merry Christmas to you, because I'll be back.
All right, so we're going to pick up where we left off last week.
Yes.
And then, tomorrow we're going to be talking with, we still talking with Steve and Blake tomorrow?
Yep, we talk with Steve and Blake. That's going to be released next week.
Yeah,
but I think it's only going to be one of the two of them, because you know they're busy as well, so they're active duty. So we'll be able to get one of the experts on tomorrow.
Cool, and we're going to talk about
active shooters.
Active shooters.
Yeah, very important. Active shooters. You know, we're going to go through the history of it. You know, how things have changed. You know, kind of what your responsibility should be to protect yourself and others. Just a whole lot of information, you know, that kind of goes along with a lot of the questions that we get about, you know, will CCW say protect if you have to deal with that?
Cool.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I got Flint Biggie here snoring
Flint Biggie's in the house.
So,
Flint Biggie, hopefully
we won't catch him on the mic snoring, but he's good to go. He's chilling out.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had an awesome talk last week, you know, and you've already released it, episode 39. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we were getting into your shooting, you know, and I thought it was really important, you know, talking about the history of CCW Safe, to really go over your shooting, because, you know, it's important, like I said last time, that, you know, if you know someone that has been through a traumatic experience like that and they're willing to talk about it, you know, you can get some true insight and as to, you know, what they went through. And that's kind of what you were sharing with us. And we appreciate you, peeling the onion, the emotional onion. And I think we kind of left off right after the shooting incident, and you were kind of getting into the homicide investigation. So the investigative portion is really, really important. And this is kind of where CCW Safe is strong within that first 48 hours of an incident.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want you to kind of tell the folks about how your process went.
Yeah, and it's, you know, for those who don't know, that's precisely why we founded this company, because when I left law enforcement, was looking for something for myself, and there really wasn't much out there. So we founded this company, and based on our experience and based on the knowledge that we have in dealing with these, you know, shootings, these investigations and so forth. And we're talking about there's a couple things that I really learned in my shooting that are key, I think, with me now, and but also with anybody who maybe going through the aftermath of a shooting, and the aftermath, talking about the investigation, what all happens next. The first thing was, you know, last week we talked about training, and during that time, I was probably at the height of my training. We were entering, I mean, we were doing, you know, entries, you know, we worked, during that time, we were working Monday through Friday. Sometimes we'd work, you know, through the weekends, we'd take trade time, but we were running at times, you know, one or two warrants a day.
Yeah.
Now, it wasn't like that for a month, but there would be a week where we might run, 8 warrants in a week. And a good deal of those were immediate entry. And so we talked about training last week and how when I first went into Impact, they really didn't have a dedicated or a set training schedule. And then when I went into Impact and then you went into Impact not too long after me in a different part of the city. You know, we were doing training a lot differently when we were on than as before. And the biggest thing that I learned was that you fall back on your training. In fact, one of my, you know, my email
quotes.
Yeah, my email signature is that we do not rise to the expectation of our training, but we fall to the level, or the level of our expectations, but we fall to the level of our training. Right. And I noticed in that because of how things happened so fast and there was no thought into what happened, it was just a reaction. And if you don't have training or you don't have an idea of what you're going to do or you're not prepared, then what are you going to fall back on? And right. you know that from tech team being involved in things and being having incidents happen where you fell back on your training, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we trained 3 days out of the month, which was awesome. That's more than most. We weren't a full-time team. We were a part-time team. But, you know, you find that those who train the most are better suited to deal with emergencies and traumatic incidents.
Yeah. And one interesting effect that not as police officers, but as police officers might see it more, but for civilians is like the bystander effect, you know, where it's like an apathy. It's a social psychological phenomenon, which people are less likely to offer help to people when other people are present.
Correct.
And that is one thing, even if you do have training, if you're in a group, you know, that's one syndrome that you commonly see. In fact, you know, the act of self-protection and a lot of these videos that people talk, you know, break down these videos of what happened. You see it all the time. You see something happen and there's like people there and nobody does anything.
Right.
And so if you don't have training and you're not aware of like effects like that or other physiological effects, which is a second thing that I really noticed, you have to be aware of that. And even if you are aware of it, you have to be able to kind of snap out of that. Yeah. One of the things that the other thing that I learned a lot about was the physiological effects that when you're put into a certain critical incident, whether it be a self-defense shooting or, you know, a car wreck, mm-hmm. Things that happen that, for example, you know, there's tunnel vision, there's auditory exclusion, there's intense second guessing, there's other physiological effects that there's a loss of motor skills, there's a memory loss, and you may be affected by those. And, you know, for like my shooting, I remember tunnel vision. The first thing right immediately, as soon as I entered the residence and turned that corner, as soon as I saw that gun rolling up, everything I had tunnel vision on that gun. That's how focused that was. And my first shot placement was on the back of the hand. So it was, everything was super focused on that.
Yes.
I also remember almost like slow motion. I remember seeing that, like the entry wounds. We talked about that last week. But at the same time, then I lost my peripheral vision. I lost my partner who is to my right, who is pretty close to me actually, but he was moving away from me as I was firing. I lost him in my vision. I thought he got hit. So everything, you know, my tunnel vision went down. I also remember, I don't remember hearing shots. I remember seeing the muzzle flash of what I thought was the suspect's firearm as he was rolling up, but it was actually my partner's muzzle flash. There was one big muzzle flash, and then my partner had a stovepipe, and he was trying to clear his gun when I started shooting. So the tunnel vision and the auditory exclusion, that can be a big deal if you're talking about let's just talk about those two for a minute. When you're talking in an interview, a police interview, what did you see?
Correct.
Okay. You're not, you know, don't be surprised to say, well, this is what I saw, and you, it's concrete in your mind, and this is what I saw. But other people who are surrounding, who might be other witnesses, may not see what you saw, because they may have seen something, you know, a wider field of vision. They may have come in right at the end. They may have seen something before. So when you're giving testimony, that's one thing to think about. Also, auditory exclusion, how many shots were fired? How many shots did the suspect fire? Mm-hmm. In my case, I remember I went home. I went to homicide, did an interview directly after, and I went home still thinking that suspect fired a shot. In fact, I was surprised later, probably 6 to 8 hours later that night, or is it into the next morning, when they advised that his gun was still loaded and he never got a round off. I mean, I was like, no, he fired, he shot one. As soon as I turned a corner, I saw his gunfire.
Yeah.
So
let's hold up right there, because and what the listeners need to know, concealed carriers more so than the police officers, because they understand this. But the concealed carrier, I mean, you have to understand, you know, a lot of times when, just like Mike said, and at that time, his perception of the traumatic event was his reality. And imagine him telling the story, if he was a citizen, that the suspect shot at him and then he shot back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that's huge. Because what it does is it brings into play another version. You know,
exactly.
It brings into, if the officers are talking to you and then they talk to three witnesses and all three witnesses say, oh, no, he never fired a shot. That's just something that you need to be aware of. And that's one reason why the IACP recommends 2 sleep cycles, 24 to 48 hours before officers are interviewed. There are a lot of departments that still interview directly after a shooting, but in my case, just like in my case, they allowed me to come back in a week later or days later and read that report to see if everything was right. that's not going to be an option for a citizen. And it's might not be an option for them to be able to wait 24, 48 hours. But the thing you need to be aware of is if you are, and you may not know it because you may be thinking that it's concrete in my mind, I know this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You need to at least be aware of these physiological effects that your mind is not right at that time.
That's
your
right.
mind is like trying to catch up.
Yes.
I think it's like, you know, you see these things happen in real time. The shots are fired. I think I fired 7 rounds in less than probably 2 seconds.
How many did you remember shooting?
I remembered shooting seven.
Okay.
Or that's what I think I was right on my rounds. I don't remember now that you say that.
That's a surprise, but, because, like, you know, most officers involved in shootings, they don't even remember. Like, some of them will go through an entire mag and think they only shot four times. And they
right.
they'll drop a mag, put one back in. So I'm surprised right. that you were
and
on
that
it.
May like be, that. You know, I mean, it's been so long. And it's funny. I was actually talking with some other people about this. Over time, what comes becomes part of your memory and story,
mm-hmm.
you know? I don't know. I can't honestly say that I did know how many rounds I shot, but I knew how many rounds I shot from the report.
Yes.
And so that may have become, you know, part of my knowledge about that.
Well, you
I
know,
do remember when I got, what's that?
I was going to say, and before you continue on, and you know, I love studying the brain. You know, I mm-hmm. watch a lot of documentaries, and there's a great documentary on Netflix that talks about memory and recalling memory. And there's a lot still not known about, you know, from experts out there that's not known about how memory works. But what they have found on the cellular level is that when you recall a memory, that if you get information fed to you that you didn't know at that time, after you recall a memory, you start to add that information,
yeah.
and then it
yeah.
becomes part of the story. So kind of what you're yeah. saying, not knowing is actually accurate.
Right, right. And I don't know, I do remember, actually I think I do remember now, not saying that I don't, at the time, I don't remember how many rounds I fired.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember actually when I got out to the corner of the house, reloading my magazine, and I dumped a live round there at the corner of the house.
Yes.
But yeah, so the auditory exclusion and tunnel vision were two that I immediately recognized. Now, I've heard people talk about, and this is, you know, people do the, you know, when they're practicing shooting, they'll do the, you know, look over each shoulder type deal.
Yeah.
And I just, I don't know, from being involved in a shooting, so I never had been trained that. We never trained that back in the day. But immediately, as soon as I recognized that my suspect was done,
mm-hmm.
I immediately looked over my shoulder to Mike Kelly, who was on my right side. Because yes. like I said earlier, I thought suspect fired. I thought he had been shot.
Yes.
I don't know why I thought that. He wasn't shooting because he was trying to clear his, he had a stovepipe.
Yes.
So maybe somehow I, even though I wasn't hearing the shots,
mm-hmm.
maybe somehow I don't know. I don't know how, but for
well,
some reason.
You know, I mean, but you also taught to be aware of where your partner is. And with you being, I'm going to assume you a cover guy, number two, right?
Yeah. But the whole point I'm trying to make is, people do this look to try to say, well, yeah. it breaks tunnel vision. It breaks, which
oh, yeah, gotcha,
I don't
gotcha.
Buy that.
Yeah.
I don't buy that because I've been involved in a shooting.
Yes.
And I don't buy that because I was never taught that. But as soon as I recognized that the fight was gone of suspect number one, I immediately turned to look for my partner.
Yes.
Some people say, well, it snaps out. I guess what I would say is I'd like to see some kind of basis, you know, scientific.
Yeah, you know, I think I would too, because, you know, I watch people do that and I say, okay, what if you're still engaged? Because if you practice shooting one, two, look, right? That's something you might do, you know, if you're involved in the shooting. You know,
yeah.
you shouldn't be looking over your shoulder that time. You should be looking forward, or you got multiple subjects before you, you know.
Right.
You shouldn't be doing
it. Well, and I don't think, you know, I think, I don't know. My thought would be that you may practice that over and over again, but when it comes actually down to the shoot, that
yeah.
you might not do that. I don't know. I
yeah.
just think that
yeah.
I just remember Uh-huh. I just remember looking, trying to look over for him, and I saw him.
Uh-huh.
And then that, and then from what I remember, my field of vision at that point, I remember being not, like not being tunnel visioned in.
And I got you too on that. And the, and I guess I'm going off of, you know, how training changed for us. You know, when we, you know, we used to take our shots and they say, go ahead and holster. And then remember it changed to about 10 years into it. They didn't want you to holster in between. They want to have a low ready.
Yeah, low ready.
Because officers got in the habit of, you know, shooting and then holstering. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that, you know, every person is going to do it. But, I mean, we're all human. You never know. Sometimes, you know,
right.
You practice something so much, you end up doing that. So that's all I'm saying. But keep it going, because, I love your story. It's interesting.
Well, the thing I was with auditory exclusion that was interesting to me was, at first, I never heard any of the shots.
Mm-hmm.
Even the first shot, that when I, like, I saw the muzzle flash, never heard any shots. I do remember my rounds bouncing off the door behind me, like hitting me on the back. At one, actually went down the shirt of McCaleb and got like in between his vest and his skin. Said
your casings, right?
My casings, not my rounds, my casings.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about the auditory exclusion, when I looked over at Mike and came back to cover suspect one, Mike was attacked from behind. He fired one shot. I heard five shots.
Wow.
So it went the opposite. It went from not hearing anything to hearing to like, you know, hearing echoes. And I remember as we exited that house, and I had, you know, a lot of friends in ATF. I had friends that were actually involved in the Waco raids, that were shot in the Waco raids. Mm-hmm. I remember as we exited that house and we got out and made our way to the corner of the house, I thought, holy crap, we have like a whole militia in here. And that's the first thing that came into my mind was Waco. I was like, holy shit, this is,
sorry.
I was telling people, get on the back, secure the back, lock the back down. I was telling other people on the other side to cover the west side. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this suspect two walks out, collapses on the front porch, and then we enter back in. So the physiological effects are it. And you said police officers know this. A lot of police officers do know this. I don't know how much they teach of that today, if they teach more or if they teach less. I remember we didn't get a whole lot of it, but I do, you know, the loss of motor skills. I've seen officers before where they've been in a shooting and they're so, like, their hand is so, they're like so shaking that they can't reholster.
Yes.
That is something that you need to really be aware of, that that's when a lot of accidental discharges might happen as you're reholstering, which we know one that happened while we were at Oklahoma City, if you remember that one. So
in Oklahoma City, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that was on reholster. And so there's these physiological effects. Those, I think, are more, a lot of those are, well, the loss of motor skills, you know, that's going to be a big safety issue if you are trying to reholster and having trouble. The biggest one that I didn't experience, but the biggest one that I learned from Dr. Artwall was the intense second guessing, mm-hmm. and how powerful that is, and how that's actually one of the most common in law enforcement. One of the most common physiological effects is, I could have done this, I should have done this. And like she had talked about, and I'm going to recommend everybody, if you're new or if you haven't seen the videos of Dr. Artwall on our site, I would strongly recommend to search Artwall on our site. I'm going to search it right quick and see if they come up, because it's ARTWOHL. And if you search that on the site, you're going to come up with, yeah, it came up right off, the survival triangle. And you have chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5. And she goes through this, what she calls a survival triangle, which is your physical survival, your mental, emotional survival, and your legal survival. And when she talks about physiological, or when she talks about intense second guessing, which she also talked about it on that video she made, if you Google Force Institute?
Yeah, Force Institute.
Art Wall Force,
Force Science Institute.
Force Science Institute.
Yes.
If you would do that too, Force Science Art Wall. If you just Google Force Science Art Wall, there's a study that then and a great video that they did on talking about Hollywood. And you have to search for that video, but she talks about it there too. And basically what she's saying is intense second guessing, that's normal. It's totally normal. It's the most common physiological effect that police officers experience. But you have to know that, okay, this is normal, that I'm thinking I could have done this, should have done this. But when you're being interviewed by detectives or the police, that is not the time to let that come into your mind and out your mouth of, well, I could have done this and I should have done this. Because as we learned through the case that we had with Stephen Maddox, even if officers are trained, they're recording that. And they're whether they're recording recording as far as writing it down, they're making a transcript of that. And that's something that you really need to be aware of, that that's normal, but there's also a place for that.
Correct.
And when you're giving an interview, that's not the place for that.
Right.
So those were the two biggest things, training and how training affects your reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And which we both know, you know, from not only your time on the street, but also teaching recruits how to survive and custody
self-defense and
control,
and yeah,
it's all that. You're going to fall back. You got to fall back on something.
Yes.
And you want to have that training there. And the second thing, these physiological effects, that was probably the two biggest things that I learned out of my shooting, that came in over the whole time from immediately when it happened all the way through the lawsuit. So
get into the interview process, because I think that's next, right?
Yeah. So during mine, I kind of touched on it. During mine, you know, it was we didn't do the 24 to 48 hour interview rule back then. I went immediately to homicide. I went to the hospital, and this, okay, here's another key point that I think that we learned that we really saw with Don West in the Zimmerman case. If you're in New York, I need to talk to Bobby about this. Those guys, but I've always heard that if an officer is involved in a shooting in New York City, they're immediately taken to the hospital, even if they don't have any injuries, because they've just been involved in this critical stress incident.
Yes.
And this critical stress incident can affect the bodies in so many ways, not only emotionally and mentally, but also physically. If you have high blood pressure, or if you have heart disease, or if you have anything else. And what we learned from Don in the Zimmerman case was that, you know, they ask George Zimmerman if he wanted to go to the hospital. He said no because he didn't know if his insurance would cover that.
That's right.
And he didn't want to, he didn't know if he had the money to, you know, to cover that. If he would have gone to the hospital, they would have recorded the injuries.
Yes.
In that case, he said, no, I don't need to go to the hospital. And the IMSA or, you know, the ambulance came out, they cleaned him up, and then they got pictures, yes. Which is one of the biggest things we tell people. Do not let anyone, unless it's a life-threatening injury, don't let anyone clean you up until you have pictures, until you have some kind of documentation of that. In that case, you know, luckily, one of the police officers had taken a picture of him really quick just to go show one of the neighbors to see who this was. And that became a big legal battle later because the prosecution was trying to hide that.
Yes.
And trying, you know, they said they didn't have it. And then they said they did have it. And they sent black and white copies. There was a copy of a copy of a copy that you couldn't really see anything. And finally, they got the actual photograph from the police officer's phone, which showed, you know, his nose is bleeding, his head. But in the other, and that was a big deal in that case because it was made out that he wasn't injured. He wasn't, you know, he really didn't need to shoot the guy, that it was all unnecessary. And so that's one thing. You know, in my case, I went to the hospital simply because as we were backing off the porch, I stepped off and cut and raked my shin, and it cut my shin. So in even then, and as I'm sure the policy is now, if there's any injury at all, that's documented, and that's why they did that. They sent me to the hospital to get that documented. So if you're involved in a shooting, you need to make sure that any injuries documented, even no matter how small. And you got to remember that these are critical incidents. And, you know, this is a big deal to your body at that time, your mind and your body going on. There's a lot going on within you at that time. So don't take it lightly that, you know, or don't try to be, you know, let your ego get, oh, I don't need to go to the hospital. I'm fine. You know, take that opportunity to get anything documented that you can. And that's huge, I think. So in my case, went to hospital, got checked out, went to homicide, met with Gary Eastridge, who is now our critical incident coordinator and our affiliate manager. And he interviewed me, did an interview, went home, and several hours later, probably, I don't know, four to six hours later, I was at home sitting on my couch and just trying to figure out what the hell just happened. Yeah. Even at that, it was like, wow, what? I don't just, you know, you just can't put it together. So my interview didn't last very long. You know, as an officer, it was a pretty clear. We had an immediate entry search warrant. We, you know, had everything in that they did. There were no questions of it initially. But in most cases, if you're involved in a shooting, I would say, you know, you're going to be prepared for probably 6 to 12 hours.
Yeah.
That you're not going to go anywhere. The biggest thing we tell people, we tell our members, and we've told them this from day one, is you want to convey that, you know, hey, look, I will cooperate any way possible. I'm happy to tell you what happened, but can't tell you right now. I would like,
That you're going pretty much, you're going to cooperate when, you know, in the presence of your attorney, and, and then it's up to your attorney. And that's what we push for, is that we ask the attorneys to try to schedule that interview for, you know, 24 to 48 hours later.
And some departments, you know, may say no.
Yeah.
They may say, well, you're going to the station and, you know, we're going to keep you there until until we interview. I mean, it's just so, you know, departments have their own policies and procedures, and it's different, you know, everywhere you go.
Yeah.
So, and that's why it's important to, and that's kind of the founding of CCW Safe was that you have to have something before you get involved in a lethal self-defense use of force.
Yes.
You have to have some plan. And as someone who had been involved in one, both shooting and lawsuit, I wanted a plan, and I wanted to have a plan ready, and I wanted to have a team ready that if I ever got into something, that it would already be in place. And that was really what we founded this after. And, you know, at the time, there were a couple companies doing them. There were insurance companies. The experience level wasn't, I didn't think I was real comfortable with that experience level. And, you know, I think that's where our strength is. One of our greatest strengths is, and it's one of our core values, is experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have everybody on our team has either been a police officer or has investigated crimes or been through that or has seen firsthand what we have done in the Maddox case. So they have a really good understanding of, you know, what we do. So after the shooting, and I said my, you know, ours was a pretty clear case, you know, even the clearest cases, there's always somebody who, you know, everybody is going to see this thing through a different lens.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you think about just daily, the people you come in, interact with daily, how different they are from you in political views, religious views, and, you know, just think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that, well, you know, and we hear this a lot, we used to hear it a lot from people, well, you know, if I'm in a shooting, you know, I'm going to be this. Yeah, but not everybody's going to see that through your view. And in my case, even other police officers, and it's just really just one in the administration, didn't see it the way that we did. And we were off for 3 months. We were on administrative leave for 3 months. They had questioned one part of the shooting, which is second suspect. They were what-ifing, you know. And everything came out fine, but we were off for 3 months, administrative leave. So that's another thing to think about. You know, you have criminal prosecution that may be possible. You have administrative actions, which they may go to the state and try to take your permit away, which we will fight for that for our members.
Mm-hmm.
And then the civil part. You know, we were initially put back 3 months, put back to work. Everything was fine. You know, initially, like right after, you know, a week or two after, when we were still off, we even had the DA sending letters over, you know, citing Chief Justice Rehnquist saying, you got to get these guys back to work. But they did, the department did their own internal investigation, which oddly enough, they never talked to us about it, which was kind of funny.
Yeah.
The two people involved. But we were put back to work and went on about our way. And 2 years later, right before the statute of limitations ran up, boom, we got hit with the civil lawsuit. So, and that became a whole new, you know, whole new battle. That was, I was talking about Higbee last time. There's a guy named Chuck Higbee who was a detective for LAPD, and he was hired as our expert witness.
Mm-hmm.
He was awesome guy. He was one of the frozen chosen from the Chosun Reservoir and Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
He had worked, I don't know how many thousands of shootings in LAPD, worked officer-involved shootings, and I learned a lot from him and just from his few days that we were with him. And, you know, he really helped us determine how fast it happened. Mm-hmm. I remember we went through a drill, kind of a deal where we worked, and we went through it several times where he would tell Mike and I to close our eyes. We'd close our eyes, and he'd say, okay, when I say go, he would have a stopwatch. He said, when I say go, I want you to both go through your mind. That's when you're entering the house. As soon as you enter the house, when I say go, you're in the house, and then tell me when you're out. Mm. And we determined after doing that several times that we were in that house for about 4 seconds. Mm. And that's how fast that happened. There was so much that happened in that 4 seconds.
That's crazy.
So that was what I was talking about. You know, that was one of the coolest. I learned more in that little time than I learned in any class that I got to, because we'd been to tons of, you know, classes and conferences when we were on the police department. But that was really cool to see how he did that. And, you know, he was really expecting. I remember him asking us. He's like, man, when I said, yeah, I'd come out and work this case, he goes, I thought something was up. You know, he goes, I thought maybe there was a dead guy in the backseat of a scout car with handcuffs on. I didn't know what to think. He goes, there's nothing here.
Yeah.
So it was nice to get that feedback from somebody on his level with his expertise. Yes. And to know, you know, I think we're sitting pretty good here, but it was still, you know, I don't know how long it took, a year, maybe a year and a half. I don't know exactly how long it took for us to get to, you know, summary judgment. We had several times where we met on weekends or, you know, days where we had to go meet with the attorneys, and we'd be there for, you know, when Higbee came in, I think he was in for 2 to 3 days, and we kind of went over all this stuff. But that preparation, you know, you have to have in a shooting case, you know, you're going to have experts, you're going to have use of force experts, you're going to have, you may have firearms experts, you may have
crime scene experts,
pathologists, you may have crime scene experts, you know, and you may have all of those. If it's a case, you know, that's going to go like Stephen Maddox's case went for a 2-week trial, you're going to pull out everything you can if you're looking at life in prison. You know, that's a harsh reality when you look at that, and when you have to deal with that every day, and that's the outcome. You know, in our outcome, it was going to be civil.
Yeah,
they did go after us punitive, but I wasn't ever really stressed out, because I knew where we stood. I knew, you know, I wasn't having to pay for it. The FOP paid for everything. Mm-hmm. So for me, it really wasn't a big deal. Now, if I had to pay that, yeah, it would be huge. It would bankrupt me at that time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to afford a defense.
Correct. Hey, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
You know, so you're talking about, you know, like going through that period, that's a long time to have to deal with that and have that stress. Although you're saying you weren't stressed over the outcome and what you did, it still brought stress into your life in reference to, you know, how you dealt with everyday life. And it affected your family, too. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, at the time I was married, I actually, at the time of the lawsuit, I was married. Mm-hmm. At the time of my shooting was 1 month to the day before my wedding.
Yeah.
So a month later, I got married, which in a way it was good, because I had all that time off and got all that. I don't know how we would have got everything done, you know, mm-hmm. if I didn't have that time off. But it did. It was because of the police family, and because of the, it was very stressful as far as the investigation going on and not going back to work. But, mm-hmm. You know, looking back on it, if I would have had to deal with that by myself, and not the financial part is a huge part, you know. To just be married and then automatically be wiped out.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, devastating.
And yeah, I've been devastating. And luckily I, you know, like I said, I didn't have that because we had the coverage from the FOP. But I don't know, it's something that it does affect you for a long time, you know. It's something that you know, I'm going through a divorce now, and there's a lot of things that happen in a 10-year period of my life. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that happen, and I don't really know if I can say that any, you know, what hinged on this.
Yes.
You know, in a 10-year time, I lost my brother, who is like my best friend. I became a police officer, or he's mm-hmm. kind of my older brother, kind of like a hero figure, became a police officer, you know, worked the Oklahoma City bombing. You were there on that. Mm-hmm. Everybody was there on that. You know, a year later, got into a shooting, almost mm-hmm. not to the day, but close to a year later. And then 2 years later, got sued in federal court, lost my left eye a year mm-hmm. later. So there was a lot that happened, and it's kind of hard to say what, you know, what part had a lasting effect. I think all of it does.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest thing is, it's just that you're not, you know, you're not the same person after that. And we talked about this last week too, of it just being a part of who you are.
Correct.
Whether it be good or bad.
Yeah.
And it may not be either, but it's just a part of who you are. So, you know, there's a lot to think about and go on. A lot of people, I think, have this thought process of, well, you know, if I get in a shooting, it'll be because I'm, you know, I have to, and I don't have any, and I'm good with that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but there's a lot more that goes to it. And I think even if you are good with that,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's something that's in the news, if it's in the paper, you know, your family may not be good with that.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have kids at that time.
Yeah.
I wasn't on the news much because it was right before the first anniversary of the bombing. So that kind of, you know, it made the news, and then it was off, and then it was on to the next thing. But I think that, you know, kids, if their parents or mom or dad are in the paper or on the news, you know, every night in reference to a shooting, then that's going to have some impact on them. You know, wives, spouses, it could have impact on. So even if it's not you, I mean, it's going to affect people around you, your family. It's going to, you know, so it's just something to think about.
Absolutely. And then, you know, that too was like long before, you know, the huge impact of social media, you know. And
oh my,
like,
gosh, yeah.
I mean, these days, I mean, you get Twittered and IG'd and Facebooked to death with everybody. And I mean, a lot of our members that you get involved in shooting, be on social media. Don't look at the comments. Don't post mm-hmm. anything, you know, to protect yourself from yourself. You know, because you can get pulled into it, and then it can help you with the, you know, the second guessing comes about,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also you'll want to defend your actions, and you don't need to be doing that on social media.
Well, that's one thing I think that I didn't talk about that I wanted to talk about was the thing. It's just natural. If you take a life, it's natural to want to defend your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes it can be like I talked about some of the things that I didn't realize, you know, it took a long time for me to really accept that the guy that he never got a round off. 'Cause I was like, no, I was just certain of that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, you know, if you have this memory gap, if you have this, if you're trying to deal mentally with what just happened and you don't know what happened, you don't know how many rounds shot, you don't know, you know, if the suspect fired or not, you don't know this, you don't know that. If you're interviewed at that time, all you can do is try to fill in the blanks to justify your actions,
right,
which can be damning to you in the long run if what you testified to is not true or goes against the physical evidence. And I'm not saying that people do this on purpose. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that somebody in that case would be lying because they really don't know. They're trying to give the best account of what they can give. But if it goes against physical evidence, if it goes against what everybody else says, if it goes against all that, then that can really be harmful. And like you said, social media, you know, one of the biggest things we saw in the case here in Oklahoma City with the pharmacist.
Yes.
Going to the media, you know. Yes. He went to the media and there were several stories that came out and several different versions. And there were several things that he said that they disproved later. And that, yes, again, damning to the, that case for his defense. So that's, you know, if you walk away there, I think there's several things to walk away from this, these two podcasts about, but to really have a good understanding of some of the things you're going to experience, to have a good understanding of where you are in your training,
mm-hmm,
you know, and to be, have a good understanding of how to handle that aftermath. Everything from the initial interview, you know, to media, everything else is very important.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I just want to say, Mike, you know, I want to thank you on behalf of, you know, the audience, our members, you know, for sharing your experience, because, you know, it really kind of gives a deep dive into what happens when you're involved in a shooting and the aftermath and, you know, kind of, mm-hmm, what goes on during that time and afterwards. And I mean, it's really important, you know, to take all this information in. So once again, thank you. I'm sure we'll get some comments to say the same. So we appreciate you guys. Yeah. Who in advance, thank you guys in advance for sending Mike, you know, love and any of your comments and in support of what he's done for you in the past two podcasts.
And we take those seriously. I mean, we read all those that come in, and it's we even know names now of some people who send stuff in frequently, and we like that. So, you know, send in comments, send in things you think you would like to hear more of, and we're going to have another great podcast coming up for you tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
All right, Stanley, good to see you.
All right, brother, I'm getting back to work, and you have a great evening.
All right, man, take care.
Bye.